Whether it was a broken arm or a broken heart, Dad's hands and his hugs could heal, especially when in service of an underdog or someone who couldn't help themselves. The other inhabitant of that double-wide trailer Dad and I were living in that summer was a pet cockatiel named Lucky. Dad loved that bird and that bird loved Dad. He'd open her cage each morning and let her fly around the trailer. She drew stand his shoulder while he walked around and perch on his forearm while he petted her. He talked to Lucky, Lucky talked to him. We only put Lucky back in her cage night to sleep the rest of the time. Lucky was loose in the trailer morning until night. The only rule was you had to watch it when you exited or entered the door. So Lucky didn't get out. One late afternoon after July day of exploring the countryside on foot, I got back to the trailer at the same time Dad got home from work. When we got inside, Lucky wasn't there to greet Dad like she always did. We looked all over, no Lucky. I thought, did I accidentally let her out this morning when I left? Did anyone else come over today while we were gone? Seconds later, I heard Dad in the back of the trailer. Oh God, no Lucky. I ran to the back and found Dad on his knees leaning over the toilet there floating in circles, and the bottom of it was Lucky. Tears dripping off his cheeks. Dad reached with both hands in the bottom of the bowl and gently cradled Lucky out.
Oh no. Lucky, no.
He groaned through sobs like he was dead, soaking wet, motionless. She must have accidentally fallen in the toilet and gotten stuck beneath the seat's edge, trying to get out. Dad, still weeping, brought Lucky, soggy and lifeless, body closer to his face. We examined her hanging head. Then he opened his mouth wide and slowly put Lucky into it until the bottom half for wings and her tail feathers were all that was outside of it. He started to give Lucky mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, only breathing through his nose. So to keep constant air flow into her lungs, he made sure his breath was measured enough. He hoped to revive her, but not so much to burst her tiny lungs. On his knees over a toilet, cradling the bottom half of a cockatiel named Lucky, with the top half of the same burden's mouth, he breathed into her with the perfect amount of pressure. 1 XL, 2 XLs, 3 XLs. His tears soaking the already saturated bird for exhales. Bye. A feather quivered.
Success sails.
7. A wingtip fluttered. 8. Dad lightly loosened his grip and released some pressure from his lips. 9. Another wing tried to flap. He opened his mouth slightly wider. 10. And that's when we heard coming from inside my father's mouth. Small chirp. Now with tears of pain turning to tears of joy, Dad gently removed Lucky's torso and head from his mouth. Lucky twitched, some toilet water and saliva off her head, now face to face. They looked into each other's eyes. She was dead. Now she was alive.
Lucky lived another 8 years.
God's Lucky. The goddess of luck is Fortune. Fortune is the sister of fate. Fate is the divine order and the divine order is God. So as far as I can tell, if you believe in luck, you believe in God. That same summer while Dad was at work every day, I explored the endless acres of the piney woods barefoot and shirtless, wearing a chamois rope around my waist with my Daisy BB gun in hand. Coming from Uvalde, I'd never seen trees like this. Towering pines shooting straight up into the sky. Thousands of them. I was in awe of one in particular, a white pine among the ponderosa, 6 feet wide at the base, its peak trespassing the airspace. One late afternoon while chasing down a squirrel with my Daisy, a half mile from home, I came across a fence about 10 feet tall. It was strangled with vines and overgrowth and a few faded no trespassing signs. I crouched, pulled back some foliage, and peeked through. On the other side was a lumberyard. Men in hard hats, a couple of forklifts in action, and mountainous stacks of 2x4s, 4x4s, and plywood. Perfect dead dot. For a tree house, and I knew just the tree, I stayed there until they shut down the forklifts, packed up, and closed down for the day. It was about 6 p.m. I ran home with the plan, a plan I couldn't tell Dad, a plan for the next 3 months of my summer. The next morning after breakfast, Dad went to work at 6:30 like he always did. As soon as he left, I went to our toolbox and found what I was looking for. A pair of wire cutters. I put on my chamois, grabbed my Daisy, left my shoes in the closet, and ran to scope out my mark. How was I going to do this? And were people working at the lumberyard all day so I'd have to come at night? I bought it. Well, if I got caught by someone at the lumberyard, what if I got caught sneaking out at night by Dad? And what if he then found out I was stealing lumber from a lumberyard half a mile from home? I was nervous. I was excited.
That night, after dinner and watching The Incredible Hulk like I always did, Dad and I said our good nights. I lay in bed wondering how long I should wait before I opened the double-wide bedroom window to sneak out. I could hear Dad still moving around on his end of the trailer, so I waited until the slightest creaks had been silent for at least an hour before I made my move. Slowly, quietly, I got out of bed. I wrapped on my chamois skirt, left my shoes in the closet, grabbed my Daisy, a small flashlight, and the wire cutters. I tossed them all carefully out the window under the lawn below, then snuck myself out the window and headed to my secret stash. It was around 1 a.m. I figured I should be back home in bed before 5, so I had a few hours to work. Yard was quiet. I threw a couple of rocks over the fence to see if any guard dogs were around. Nothing. I pulled back some vines and bushes. Then with the flashlight between my chin and chest I brought the wire cutters to the first chain link with both hands. Clip. It took all my double-fisted bite to cut through it. Clip. 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 Until I had clear space about 6 feet wide and a foot tall wide enough to get those plywood planks through small enough to go unnoticed, I hoped. Adrenaline pumping, I lay on my back and shimmied under the fence under the private property. I went to the stack of 4x4s, pulled one off and dragged it to the opening in the fence. I pushed it through as far as I could, then crawled under the fence and pulled it out from the other side, where I then dragged it a few 100 yards deep into the forest and left it at the base of the big white pine. Then I ran back to steal the next one. Once I got my second load to the tree, it was already a little after 4:30 a.m., so I raced back to the fence, replaced all the brush and vines to conceal the whole light cut, then ran back home, snuck in the window, but my Daisy and the flashlight back on the shelf and the wire cutters under my mattress got under the covers and slept until Dad woke me up at 6 a.m. to make breakfast. It went on like this for over a month, getting little sleep at night. I'd take cat naps under that white pine next to my growing stack of lumber during the day, then make it home for dinner and do it all over again. I did this every night until I had enough 2x4s, 4x4s, and plywood planks to build the biggest, tallest treehouse in the world. With the most dangerous part of my plan behind me and 2 months of summer left, it was time to start construction. I'd also stolen about 40 feet of 15-gauge steel trim pin nail gun nails from the yard, and I already had a hammer and a 26-inch handsaw from the toolbox at home. All I needed was daylight. Up at 6 o'clock and out the door by 7, I worked on that treehouse until dark 7 days a week for the next 2 months, shirtless and shoeless in my chamois. I crisscrossed 2 paper collated clips of the nails over my shoulders and across my chest. Half Comanche Indian, half Pancho Villa, with hammer in hand. I went to work. I started with the bottom floor, then I built that. I cut a 2x2 foot hole in each floor next to the trunk of the tree, where I nailed pieces of 2x4s for ladder steps to get from floor to floor. I also made a pulley system that I raised with each floor. I'd pack my lunch each morning and take it to my construction site, put my brown bag in the trough, climb up to the highest floor, and hoist my sandwich up to eat during my lunch break. 6 weeks later, when I was done, my treehouse was 13 stories high. The 13th floor was over 100 feet above the ground. From there I could see all the way to downtown Longview, 15 miles away. For the next 2 weeks I spent every day up there above the rest of the world, where I hoisted my brown bag lunch and daydreamed swearing. I could see the Earth's curve on the horizon. Now understanding where and why the city of Longview got his name. It was the best summer of my life. Green light, then September came and I had to go back to school. Mom came back from Florida and we soon moved into a neighborhood house on the other side of town. I never saw that treehouse again. I often wonder if it's still there today. I thought of that treehouse when I was making the movie Mud. My treehouse was those boys' boat in a tree, a secret, a mystery, a place of danger, wonder and dreams. If Mud had been released in 1979, my dad would have come to me and said, "Hey buddy, there's this movie called Mud I saw, we gotta watch it together. Damn, it's a good one." Then I might have said to him, "Dad, there's this treehouse in the woods I built. I gotta show it to you, Dan. It's a good one." Oh yeah, that extended vacation in Florida. My mom was on it would be 20 years before I learned that. In fact, she was not on vacation. Rather, she and Dad were in the middle of their second divorce. It's not vanity, it's commerce. Until it's vanity again. During high school we still lived at that same house on the other side of town and Longview. Mom had just started selling a product called Oil of Make, a facial cosmetic that she peddled door to door. It was touted as a breakthrough skincare treatment that would bring out all the impurities of your skin and saturate your face with beautiful mink oil so that you would have a clear glowing complexion for the rest of your life. At the same time, I was entering adolescence, you know, pubic hairs grown and balls dropping, voice lowering, and a few pimples. One day my mom looked at my face and she said you should use the Olive Make. A fan of self-regard and looking my best, I listened to her and started applying oil of mink to my face each night before bed. The result? More pimples. It must be bringing out all the impurities, mom said. I listened to her again and continued to slather more oil of mink on my face each night. A week went by. More pimples. 12 days passed. Now I had that look like full-blown acne, mom. Are you sure this is okay for me to be using? I asked. Of course it is, but you know what? Let's call my boss Elaine to come over and have a look just to be sure. Elaine came over and took a look at my swollen zit-infested face. Oh wow, she shrieked. Yes, the product is doing exactly what it's supposed to do. It's bringing out all the impurities in. Oh my, oh by, you must have a lot of communities, Matthew. Just keep applying the old make each night and eventually it'll pull all the impurities out. And then you're going to clear glowing complexion for the rest of your life. Well, okay. Sounded like I just needed to weather the storm. I stayed at it. 3 weeks and my entire cheeks were swollen, red pustules, huge whiteheads, blistering geysers of pus. I look like a different person. Against my mother's counsel, I decided to see a dermatologist. Dr. Haskins. He looked at my face. Oh my Matthew, what the did the pores on your face, they're clogged and holding in oil and grease that there's no room for them to breathe. What are you putting on your face? He asked. I pulled out a bottle of the old mink. He examined the label. How long have you been using this product, Matthew? 21 days. So my God, no, Matthew, this is for people that are at least over 40 years old. Definitely not for a teenager going through adolescence when your skin is securing more oil. This product has completely blocked your pores. Matthew, you have severe nodular acne. You are 10 days away from having ice pick scars in your cheeks for the rest of your life. Young man, I am going to prescribe you a pill called Accutane. Hopefully we've caught it in enough time that the Accutane will dry you out to such an extent that maybe you can get rid of the acne within a year. Do not have lifelong damage. Well, that olive mink didn't work at all, did it? Matthew, mom innocently proclaimed, no ma'am, it didn't. I immediately got off the oil of mink and got on the Accutane, which came with its own set of side effects. After a few weeks my skin started drying out. My face began to scale and flake, decreases in my lips, dried up and bled my knees. Got arthritic. I got headaches, my hair started falling out. I got hypersensitive allergic reactions. And I look like a swollen prune. All side effects that I was more than happy to live with to get rid of my oil of mink-induced acne. That's not the end of the story, no, not in the McConaughey household. See my dad. He smelled an opportunity. We're going to assume that Alamine Company. That's what we'll do. We're going to assume and make some money off of this whole deal. I mean, look at you, son, that product should have never been given out to you, boy. And that lady Elaine? She shouldn't have been telling your mother to give it to you. I'm telling you, son, we got a case. Dad took me to meet his lawyer, Jerry Harris. A good-looking, erudite, middle-aged man who had an air of competence about him that made you think he was from Dallas, not Longview. Well, you damn right. We got a case, Jerry said. This product should have never been administered to a teenager. There's no disclaimer or warning on the bottle about its possible harms either, and I'm sure that besides all the physical pain you're going through. Jerry and my dad homed in on me. You are under great emotional distress as well. Aren't you, Matthew? Yes. Jerry pulled out a cassette recorder and pressed the red button. Yes, what he asked. I am under great emotional distress at this time, why he asked. Nodding, because I now have bad acne on my face, and I never had it before using this olive mink product exactly, Cherry said. And has this predicament affected your confidence? Yes, sir, in what way? It's lower. Good. Has it affected your relationship with the girls? Why, I mean, I was doing really good with the girls before I had the acne, and I'm not doing as well now. Exactly, Jerry said, stopping the tape recorder. We got a case. Jim, emotional distress is a strong tack for prosecution and inhale. Look at him. He's all swole up. Looks like. I think we can get about 35 to 50 grand out of this deal. Big gunslinger's grin spread across my dad's face. He gave Jerry a heavy attaboy handshake and patted me on the back. Good job, boy, good job. Well, as you know, lawsuits take a while. 2 years had passed since the oil of mink applications, and with my acne now long gone, not a pimple on my face and no side effects inside the Accutane had worked. I was now being called into a deposition with the defense attorney representing oil of mink. Cassette recorder on the desk. Red button pressed. Matthew, how are you, son?
Well, I'm doing better.
Thank you. You know, I'm just so sorry this all happened to you, Matthew. It must have been such an emotionally distressful time for you.
I couldn't believe it.
The defense attorney just lobbed me a softball and I was ready to crush it over the fence.
Oh, yes, sir, it was a highly emotional distressful time.
I mean, I look like the Elephant Man and my scalp was dry. My hair was falling out, my knees hurt my back, hurt my face, flaked. I didn't have any competence and then I wouldn't do any good with the girls. I mean, that Olamike almost scarred me for life.
Well, bless your heart.
Young man. I can only imagine how tough it must have been and still is on you.
I double down.
Yes, sir, that's right. He stared at me a moment, and then the slightest Cheshire grin began to creep up on his lips. As he reached under the table and pulled out a high school yearbook. My high school yearbook from that year 1988, he slowly opened it and turned to a flag page. Swiveled the book around to face me and slid it in my direction, then reaching across the table he put his finger on a particular picture and said,
"Is this you?"
It was a picture of me with Camisa Springs. We both had a silk sash draped across our chest from shoulder to hip. Hers read "Most beautiful, mind read most handsome." I knew right then, and there a case was done. He had me scarred for life, huh? So emotionally distressed, he said as his dream got wider. I was right. We were done. Case dropped, my dad was inconsolable. He went on about it for weeks muttering, "You boy, here I am. I got a chance to make $35,000 to $50,000 on a lawsuit that we could have won. And you gotta go off and win. Most handsome. You screwed up the whole lawsuit. Damn you, boy." And there is the picture of being Camisa Springs. Yes, that sash says "Most handsome, case closed." There is, and there's liars. The difference is the liar tries to hide his while the lets you know he's lying. That's why I like more than liars. A few months later, with mom on her second extended vacation to Navarre Beach, not another divorce. This time it was just a little break from each other. It was just dad and me living together again, this time in our three-bedroom house instead of the double-wide. I got home by midnight curfew unexpectedly. Dad was awake and on the phone.
"Sure, Mr. Felker.
He just got in. Let me ask him." I heard him say as I entered the bedroom. The lights were on and he was sitting on the side of his bed in his underwear. He lowered the phone from his ear and held it between his neck and shoulders.
"What do you do tonight, son?"
I should have known I was busted, but instead chose to try and hustle the man who had taught me to hustle.
"Not much.
You know me and Bud Felker. We went to Pizza Hut and then he dropped me off here at home," he said.
"Did you pay for that pizza, son?"
He was giving me a second chance to come clean and avoid getting punished for the one thing worse than getting caught misbehaving. Lying about it. But rather than admitting what I'd done and instinctually knew he knew I had done, I chose to double down on my gravel.
"Well, I think so, Dad. I mean, I went to the car before Bud and I'm pretty sure he was supposed to pay for it."
Digging my own grave. I was in too deep to climb out.
Now that took a deep breath.
Adelaide blanked and looked distraught for a moment. Then he lifted the phone back to his ear.
"Mr. Felker, thank you, sir. I'll handle mine from here."
He then placed the phone back in his holster. I was now starting to sweat. Dad calmly put his hands on his knees and raised his chin to look him in the eye. When I saw his mother's meat. "I'm going to ask you one more time like this, son. Did you know you were going to steal that pizza?" All I had to say was, "Yes, your dad, I did," and he would have only cussed me out about not committing a crime thoroughly enough to get away with it and maybe lashed me with his leather belt a couple times because I got caught. But no. Me, my eyes widened quarter size, spot of urine now showing on the crotch of my jeans. I stuttered.
"No, sir, like I mean, look like I said, wow."
The back of my father's right hand crashed across my face as he leapt from the bed and interrupted my pitiful plea.
I hit the ground, not so much from the force of his strikers. From the instability of the cowardly, panic-stricken lactic acid legs I was wobbling on, I deserved it. I earned it. I asked for it. I wanted it. I needed it. I got it. I lied to him and it broke his heart. Stealing a pizza, it was no big deal to him. He'd still have plenty of pieces in his life, and then some. All I had to do was admit it, but I didn't. Now, on my knees crying from shock and fear, just like my brother Mike had done, but for different reasons I was ashamed. Unlike him at the barn, I was a rat, a pink coward. That's not my boy, Katie. That's yours is all I could hear in my mind. He stood over me. The waitress at the Pizza Hut recognized Bud. She looked up his number and called his house, asked his dad to have him bring the money for the pizza by tomorrow, but told his dad it was all his idea to steal it, and that you just went along with it. But you lied to me, son. He told me he didn't know. All he wanted to do was stand up like a man, admit Dad. Look him in the eye and shake it off, but no. A coward made excuses and whimpered as he looked down on me, stain on my jeans now spread to my leg. Getting more furious with my spinelessness. He dropped on all fours like a bear in front of me, then taunted me, come on, come on, I'll give you 4-1 for your best shots across my kisser to one of mine across yours. Paralyzed, numb, I didn't take the offer. The idea of striking my dad made my hands feel like paper mache. The thought of him striking me made my brain drain. Why, he raged. Unable to answer, I just stumbled and a level and crawled to the nearest corner where I stayed until he finally stood up and shook his head at me, wondering what he'd done wrong. To raise such a coward of the son. I've often regretted what I did or didn't do that night. I had my chance at my rite of passage right there to become his boy or a man in his eyes. But I got stage fright. Kiss my pants failed the test. I joked. Part 2, Find Your Frequency. Spring 1988, my senior year in high school, I was rolling. I had straight A's, a job that kept $45 in my pocket at all times. A 4 handicap in golf, I'd won most handsome in my class and was dating the best-looking girl at my school and at the school across town. Yeah, I was catching green lights, never the too cool for school guy who leans against the wall and smokes his cigarette at the party. No, I was the guy who danced at the party. The guy who chased the girls and worked his way to the front row of every concert, no matter how late I arrived, I gave effort. I was a hustler. I drove a truck. I took the girls off road mud, and after school in that truck I had a megaphone in the front grill and in the school parking lot. In the mornings I'd crowds down in the cab and say through the speaker things like, look at the jeans Kathy Cook's got on today. Looking good. Everybody loved it. Everyone laughed. Especially Kathy Cook. I was that guy. I was the fun guy, I engaged. One day I was driving past our local Nissan dealership and I saw a candy red 300ZX for sale. I've never had a sports car before and this one even had T-tops. Baby. I pulled my truck onto the lot to inquire. The dealer was motivated to sell on the spot. I traded my truck in for that. Candy red 300ZX with T-tabs. Now I had a red sports car. Every Sunday afternoon, I'd polish and wax that red sports car. It was my baby at school. I started parking in the third parking lot. You know that empty lot way in the back where no other car doors could dent or scratch my new baby's paint. I knew the chicks were going to dig my red sports car even more than my truck and hence dig me more. I'd arrive early to school every morning, park in that third parking lot, and just lean against it. I was so cool, my red sports car was so cool. A few weeks passed and I started noticing some changes. The chicks, they weren't digging me like they used to. It was like they were bored with me leaning against my red sports car. After school they went mudding off-road in someone else's truck instead of cruising the streets T-tops down with me. I wasn't getting near as many dates as I used to. The girls seemed to lose interest in me. What happened? I wondered. Then one day it hit me. I lost my truck. I lost the effort, the hustle, the mud, and the megaphone. I lost the fan cause I was too busy leaning against that candy red 300ZX with T-tops in the third parking lot. I've gotten lazy, started looking in the mirror at my hair too often, relying on that red sports car to do the work for me, and it was doing a job. I'd outfox myself. When I traded in my truck for that red sports car, and I lost my mojo when I did so the next day. After school I went back to that Nissan dealership and traded it back in for my truck. The day after I pulled into the first parking lot again, flirted with the ladies from the megaphone and took him all off-road mud and after school and like clockwork, I was back.
Red sports car. Green line. Note to self. Process of elimination and identity. The first step that leads to our identity in life is usually not I know who I am, but rather I know who I'm not. Process of elimination. Too many options can make a tyrant out of any of us, so we should get rid of the excess in our lives that keep us from being more of ourselves. When we decrease the options that don't feed us, we eventually almost accidentally have more options in front of us that do. Knowing who we are is hard. Eliminate who we're not first, and we'll find ourselves where we need to be. On my 18th birthday, my parents said to me, "Look, if you haven't learned it yet, you're not going to." In my family, the 18th birthday was a seminal moment. It meant no more rules. It meant no more curfew. It meant independence. It meant freedom. I graduated from high school, and like most kids, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. I mean, I thought I wanted to go to law school and become a defense attorney, but I wasn't absolutely certain. My mom came up with this radical idea. "Hey, you love to travel, Matthew. What if you become an exchange student immediately?" I was up for it. Sounds adventurous and wild to me. I'm in. We went to the local Rotary Club that ran the exchange program and learned that they had two openings for a foreign exchange, one to Sweden and one to Australia. Sun beaches surfing. Elle McPherson, English speaking, I chose Australia. Next thing I knew, I was sitting in the boardroom in front of 12 suits at the local Rotary Club. After they approved my background papers, Amon said, "Matthew, we think you'd be a great ambassador of the state of Texas and the United States in the faraway land of Australia. We'd love for you to go, but before you do, we need you to sign this paper saying you will not come back until your full year of this exchange is over." Well, that seemed odd, but I am going the whole year. That's the plan. "Well, everyone says that," he retorted, "but the reason we need you to sign this contract is because every exchange student gets severely homesick and tries to come home early. We can't have that happen, which is why we need you to sign this document stating that I, Matthew McConaughey, promised not to come home early. Unless there is a tragedy or a death in my family." "Look," I said, "I'm not signing that paper, but shake on it. I'm not going to quit and come home. I'm in for the entire year." I looked him in the eye. "Deal." He agreed, we shook, and soon I was packing up to go to Australia for a full year. I'd leave in 10 days. A few days later, I got my first letter from my Australian host family, the Dooleys. It read, "We can't wait to meet you and so looking forward to having you in our home, Matthew. We live here in Paradise, near the beach, on the outskirts of Sydney. You're gonna love it." Yes, outstanding everything, I was open for the beach, Sydney. This was going to be a blast. Australia, here I come. Day 1. I arrived at the Sydney International Airport terminal and duffel bag over my shoulder. I was walking down a long ramp toward a huge room with thousands of people waiting their arrivals. When I heard through the sea of people chatting and greeting their guests, "Mateo, Mateo, Mateo." My eyes went to the sound. I saw a hand popping up and down above all the other heads and moving toward the end of the ramp. "Mario, Mario, Mario." As I reached floor level, the owner of that bouncing hand who was yelling my name was there to greet me with an eager smile. He lowered that hand and I shook it. "Meet Norvell Dooley. 5'4", 220 pounds, mustache, balding head. And a bit of an English accent." I would later come to find out was an affectation. He used to appear more proper. "Oh, there he is. Look at him, strong, handsome American boy. Welcome to Australia, son, you're gonna love it." He introduced me to his wife, Marjorie, wearing a white polyester dress with big green polka dots. She was 4'10" and using a walker because of a kyphotic spinal deformity, which back then we had called a hunchback. I leaned down and gave her a big hug and kiss, and she reached up and held my face in her hands. Then warmly said,